We now turn our attention to two documents from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith that deal specifically with bioethical issues, Donum Vitae, published in 1987, and a second document, Dignitas Personae, in 2008. And as we'll see, Donum Vitae attempts to rearticulate traditions that have already been stated and apply them to newly developing issues and to provide the fundamental theological underpinnings for decision-making in the technological issues that will continue to evolve and arise. What we'll then find is that in 2008, Dignitas Personae applies itself to an astonishing variety of new technological questions. And here again, we'll need to look very briefly and rather superficially at these documents, noting only the points they make that will be highlighted in subsequent documents, because we will be looking at these concepts in more detail in later sections of the course. The point of all of this is to give us a sense of the general sweep of magisterial documents concerned with bioethics at the end of the 20th and at the beginning of the 21st centuries. So, beginning with Donum Vitae, I've included a section number one that is particularly focused on what we've already seen in the Church's definition of the human life beginning at the question, at the moment of conception, at the time of conception, at the bringing together of the sperm and the egg. And here is raised the question, how could a human individual not be a human person? So the language of human being has been used, and here it is going to be extended to include personhood, which again is a notion, that, a term that is used differently in different philosophical contexts, sometimes having to do primarily with intellect or the capacity for intellection, and on in other contexts, more specifically, with the definitions of humanity that have to do with being possessed of a human soul. So, we notice in the third sentence that I've quoted, from the first moment of its existence, from the moment the zygote has formed, it demands the unconditional respect that is morally due to a human being. And in the next sentence, the human being is to be respected and treated, and I've underlined this, as a person. Ut persona observanda, is to be observed, is to be treated as a person from the moment of conception. Ab eius conceptione. As we'll see, this is an extension of what has already been said to include not only the language of human being, but also to include especially the rights of a person to be observed from the moment of conception, however one defines personhood or however one understands the not commented on or defined question of ensoulment. The person is to be respected, is to be treated, is to given the rights of a human person. A little bit further on, the embryo must also be defended in its integrity, tended and cared for. Now, there is a footnote that defines zygote, and I want to make you all aware of the fact that the English translation of this is wrong and potentially dangerous. The Latin says zygotum est cellula orta a fusione duorum gametum. The zygote is the cell produced when the two gametes have fused. Unfortunately, the English translation has when the nuclei of the two gametes have fused. Someone translated this who thought they knew a lot about cellular anatomy and histology, and as it turns out, they've made a very important translational and even a potentially philosophical mistake, because the nuclei of the gametes do not fuse until later, several hours, perhaps longer, after the time of the penetration of the egg by the sperm. So this bad translation would suggest that there is not a zygote until the fusion of the nuclei, but that is not what the original Latin says. So if you have occasional to teach from this document, you might want to point out that the English translation is in error at this point. That error is not made, for example, in the Spanish, French, or German translations of this text. It may seem trivial, but in fact, given the fact that there are individuals who would like to push back from conception to a later point, the definition of personhood or even humanity, being clear on this point is very important, and it's difficult to know why this mistake was made. But in any case, let's continue on. Number two, and we'll just very briefly note that what is now happening is that in this document, the congregation is attempting to lay the groundwork for looking at many of the important issues that arise in regard to the beginning of life. Number two, is prenatal diagnosis morally licit? And the answer is yes. It is permitted to diagnose in advance of the birth of the child as long as the purpose is safeguarding the life and integrity of the embryo and as long as the procedure doesn't harm the individual. If it is not prenatal diagnosis for the sake of abortion, but rather for the sake of knowing and preparing for the birth of the child, then it is permissible. Number three, are therapeutic procedures carried out on the human embryo licit, and as one would expect, if they respect the life and integrity of the embryo, if they don't involve risk? What about in vitro fertilization? And the conclusion, it is immoral to produce human embryos destined to be exploited as disposable biological material, whether for experimentation or as extra embryos for implantation. Then number six, how do you judge other procedures of manipulating embryos? Well, the procedures are contrary, as I've highlighted, to human dignity, and at the same time are contrary to the right of every person to be conceived and to be born within marriage and from marriage. So the manipulation and creation of embryos is itself problematic. Now, further on, and we'll see that this is explained even further in the document we'll be considering in another moment, the freezing of embryos constitutes an offense against the respect that is due to human beings. There's also a general statement about attempts to manipulate chromosome or genetic inheritance. If they're not therapeutic but are aimed at producing selectively certain kinds of human beings, that is, of the right gender or having other characters, then these manipulations are contrary to the dignity of the person and their integrity. If we drop down now to Section 2, Interventions on Human Procreation, Section 2A, heterologous artificial fertilization, that is, artificial fertilization in which one or both of the gametes do not come from the parents. That is, the egg or the sperm comes from someone else other than the parents, and of course the Church says that this is not permissible. This constitutes effectively a kind of genetic adultery. The unborn child, the text says, must be born as the fruit of marriage. Number three in this section, is surrogate motherhood licit? No, for the same reason. It's contrary to the unity of marriage. Now, this would be surrogate motherhood in which another woman might in fact carry the genetic product of a marriage where the father and mother arrange for someone else to carry their child. The Church is opposed to this, and we might add, and we will look at this in more detail later in the course, this has become a big industry in certain countries, most notably in India. Then Section B, homologous artificial fertilization, where it is an artificial technique, but the gametes, the sperm and the egg, do come from the parents. Is homologous in vitro fertilization licit? Well, the Church points out first, it is not marked by all the ethical negativity found in extra-conjugal procreation. That is, since it does involve the gametes from the parents, it's not as sinful. However, the Church is opposed to in vitro fertilization and states here that it is in itself illicit, because it's in opposition to the dignity of procreation and conjugal union. It takes place apart from the act of sexual intercourse between the married man and the woman. And even if everything is done to avoid the death of the human embryo, so in vitro fertilization, even when it does not involve the creation of extra embryos, is still opposed by the Church. The comment is that every child that comes into the world must be accepted as a gift, a reminder that even if the child is the product of in vitro fertilization, the child is not at fault, and the child should be loved and cared for. Then, in number six, how is homologous artificial insemination? Well, what the Church tries to say is that if this is a technique that is not replacing but facilitating the conjugal act, the act of intercourse, if it is doing that in order to help reach its natural objectives, it could be morally acceptable. But there are problems, particularly the means of obtaining a semen from the male. Masturbation is not regarded as a morally acceptable way of obtaining gametes. So, number seven, what criteria can be proposed in regard to medical intervention? A medical intervention which is intending to assist the conjugal act, either in order to facilitate its performance, such as the use of a drug. Something like Viagra is not in itself sinful. Now, it is often used in the world simply to enhance libido, but if it is actually being used medically to enable a sexual intercourse to take place between a married couple, it is perfectly legitimate. That kind of an intervention, or an intervention that is enabling the act to achieve its objective once it's been normally performed. So there is, at least in theory, the possibility that there could be techniques that follow after intercourse that could help in perhaps the case of a woman with a blocked fallopian tube. But we'll look at that again in more detail later in the course. And again, there are problems with this, but at least it is theoretically possible that such techniques might be licit. There's acknowledgement in number eight of the suffering that exists as a result of infertility, and a reminder which will be reiterated later in the Catechism and in other documents: the child is not an object to which one has a right. There is no right to a child, nor can a child ever be regarded as the object of ownership. A child is a gift, the supreme gift, the most gratuitous gift of marriage. So if the question of rights arises, it is not that the parents have a right to a child, but that the child has rights which may be violated by the parents imposing their own wills. Then, finally, the last section of this document that I've included here is the question of moral and civil law, and I've included these two paragraphs simply because they raise the point that these technological interventions could be used for a kind of new eugenics. And in particularly, the word eugenism is used, and there is a warning against forms of discrimination between human beings that would come to be legitimized. That is, certain kinds of people would be regarded as legitimate, as having the right to be born, and others would not be. A warning how modern techniques of reproduction could be used to facilitate the problematic ends of eugenics. What we have in the document Dignitas Personae is a truly remarkable follow-up published just a few years ago to Donum Vitae. It is a continuing application of the principles that had been described to the ongoing development of medical technology, and it represents a truly valiant effort on the part of the Church to keep abreast of these developments and to comment on them and to let Catholics know how to regard them or reflect on how to regard them and which of them can be incorporated appropriately into one's life. Here again, please do not worry at all the technical details. Many of the procedures that are going to be described here are technically complex. We will look at them in more detail and consider them rather more slowly and carefully a little later in the course. My goal in having us rather, you know, quickly almost flash through this document is simply so that you can be aware of how serious the Church has been in the last few years of commenting on, reflecting on, and grappling with developments in technology. So let's just kind of glance over this, look at it briefly, reminding ourselves that we will be looking at these subsections in more detail a little later. So, with the first section, Techniques for Assisting Fertility, this is largely a restatement of what we've already seen, that heterologous artificial fertilization, whenever the genetic material comes from someone other than the parents, is absolutely rejected. But procedures that are simply aimed at removing obstacles are licit and indeed are to be encouraged. So the next section on number 14, in vitro fertilization, this is a continuation and what one might regard as a follow-up. There's a note that the number of embryos sacrificed is extremely high. I should add that what I have done for the sake of this webpage is combine both the original document, Dignitas Personae itself, and the official summary and commentary on the document, which was then subsequently issued by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So all of the text here does come from the CDF, but it does represent a somewhat of an amalgam between those two texts. So, it's noted in number 14 that the number of embryos sacrificed is extremely high. It represents a purely utilitarian treatment of human beings, of embryos, and so in vitro fertilization is even more problematic than it was regarded as being some years before. A new technique in number 17, which is very widely used in some fertility clinics, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which is not simply allowing the sperm to come into contact with the egg, as it were, normally, or as it would happen in nature, but choosing a particular spermatozoan or a genetic material that hasn't yet become a fully competent sperm, and injecting it directly into the egg cell. This procedure is rejected, is regarded as morally illicit for the same reasons that a number of other procedures are regarded as inappropriate, because it completely separates procreation and the conjugal act. The very complex moral problem of frozen embryos, not only that this is itself problematic, the Church had already said that cryopreservation, freezing embryos, is incompatible with the respect that is owed to them, but of course now that this has been going on for some years, the issue arises, what about the tens of thousands or perhaps hundreds of thousands of frozen embryos that exist throughout the world? What can be done for them? And the answer that the Church offers is there is no legitimate solution at this time. The specific statement is, it needs to be recognized, and this is a direct quotation from the official document itself, that the thousands of abandoned embryos represent a situation of injustice which in fact cannot be resolved. In other words, the Church does not officially approve of the practice of embryo adoption, so-called, where a couple would say, we choose to take a frozen embryo, my wife will carry this child, and we will make this child our own. What the Church has pointed out is that this means you are contributing to, and in a sense facilitating, the practices that created the frozen embryos in the first place. Now, this is a source of significant controversy in the Catholic community, and you'll find that our textbook tries to rationalize and justify the possibility of so-called embryo adoption. But again, it's clear that the Magisterium has said that there is no official approval of this, and that there simply is no solution. The best solution is to try to do everything one can to prevent this from happening. Number 20, the freezing of oocytes, that is to say of egg cells, while it's not immoral to freeze an egg cell in itself, if it's done for the purpose of artificial procreation, then it is morally unacceptable as a practice. Number 21, the reduction of embryos, an issue that has arisen because in vitro fertilization, multiple embryos are placed within the woman's uterus, and as a result, very often there are multiple gestations. That is, the woman ends up carrying twins or triplets or quadruplets, and with a large number of babies being carried, this represents a threat to the mother, and extremely often the obstetrician will recommend that all but one of these infants be killed. So that's, you know, rather euphemistically referred to as embryo reduction. It is, of course, a grave moral disorder. It is, in fact, a form of abortion, the reduction of the number of individuals in a multiple pregnancy. In number 22, pre-implantation diagnosis, as was noted before, it's not a problem unless you intend to use the information in order to have an abortion. New forms of preventing pregnancy are mentioned in number 23 and specifically rejected. In part 3 of this document, the question of gene therapy, advanced and even science fiction-esque kinds of questions, gene therapy for human beings, human cloning, hybridization, mixing human genetic material with that of animals, are raised and grappled with by the magisterium. And the question of gene therapy, if you are performing a therapeutic intervention on somatic cells, that is not on the gametes, the sperm or the egg, if you're doing this strictly for therapeutic purposes, it would in principle be legitimate. The fact that it's done at the level of the chromosome does not necessarily make the intervention itself wrong, but in the present state of research, it's not morally permissible to act in a way that may cause possible harm to the resulting progeny. If you engage in gene therapy, is this going to affect the production of gametes, of sperm or egg, by the prospective parent? And one would have to be aware of the potential harm that might be done to one's offspring. And there's also the notation that the dangers of certain forms of gene therapy are that it would be associated with a eugenic mentality, which we've commented on before and which we will bring up again in the next section of our course. Human cloning, numbers 28 and 30, is illicit, intrinsically illicit, is wrong in and of itself. And in regard to the question of creating embryos for the sake of destroying them, even if your intention is to help the sick, that's utterly incompatible with human dignity. You cannot create a human being in order to save another human being. You can't create one person in order to sacrifice them for another. And some very advanced techniques towards the end of set number 30, altered nuclear transfer or oocyte-assisted reprogramming, these techniques, which we again will look at later, may represent licit ways forward, not of performing cloning, but of developing tissue that might be of value to people. But there are serious questions regarding what it is that comes into existence. You know, what is what you will produce anything like a human being? And that, of course, is a very important philosophical and theological question. So the church is rather dimly watching this kind of development at this point and concerned about what it would mean for that which is produced. Under number 32, therapeutic use of stem cells, I hope we're all aware of the fact that anything that destroys embryos, even if the claim is made that this is for the good of others, is absolutely immoral. So embryonic stem cell research is absolutely forbidden. But adult stem cell research or stem cells that are created from umbilical cord blood or even that are taken from a fetus that has died of a natural cause, these are regarded as legitimate sources of stem cells. It's the point is that you cannot create an embryo and then destroy it in the name of helping someone else in order to create stem cells or for any other reason. And number 33, hybridization, that is mixing human and animal cells, is an offense against human dignity. And number 35, this is an issue that does come up quite regularly. What about the fact that some biological material, even some vaccines that are used right now, have ultimately been generated by using stem cell lines that were obtained from abortion? Does that represent complicity with an immoral act? And the church is very generous in regard to this, recognizing that you certainly don't want to not vaccinate children and thus run the risk of them acquiring fatal illnesses. But it's important, as this statement notes, that the moral requirement be safeguarded, that there be no complicity in direct abortion, and that the risk of scandal be avoided. This is particularly true for the organizations that are producing the material that will be used ultimately to create vaccines. vaccines. So people who sit on those boards need to be very clear that they cannot, as Catholics, be complicit in abortion. But, the document says, there are differing degrees of responsibility. Grave reasons may be proportionate to justify the use of such biological materials. And this is specifically stated now in the highlighted text. Thus, for example, danger to the health of children could permit parents to use a vaccine which was developed using cell lines of illicit origin, recognizing that people have the duty to make their disagreement known and to encourage their healthcare system to do everything to make other kinds of vaccines available. So if this is the only kind of vaccine available, then the church would say that it is tragic, it is unfortunate that it was created using material taken from an intentional abortion. And one should certainly register one's concerns about that, but for the sake of the health of the children, one is permitted to use these vaccines. And we'll stop at this point and continue in our next lecture with documents that come from the pen of Pope John Paul II.